Good evening. Welcome to Left, Right and Center. I'm Vishnu Shom. On the show tonight, deadly floods in Africa, summer wildfires, incredible rainfall in parts of India, Himachal Pradesh, for example, record global temperatures, rising maritime temperatures. This is all unprecedented in humanity. This is all happening as a result of climate change. It's no longer talk. We can see it on the ground. Millions, in fact, billions around the world are being directly impacted. Environmental activists say that there is no doubt anymore that urgent collective action is needed and that we must have a livable planet at any cost. There's a very important meet taking place. It's called COP28. It's the UN climate talks which have begun or will be beginning soon in Dubai. We'll be looking at the significance of this meet and just what is at stake. What are some of the key talking points? Because we need to be talking about climate now. We cannot wait. This is Parmeshwar's report on what it's all about.
You know, as global leaders gather in Dubai for the COP28 conference, a scientific consensus is growing that annual global temperatures are on the cusp of exceeding 1.5 degrees Celsius for the first time. This year's climate change summit is especially critical. It actually marks the first time that countries will take stock of how far we've come as a collective in addressing climate change and how far we still have to go. Many environmentalists and other analysts, though, have raised concerns about COP28's choice of president. Sultan Al Jaber, the CEO of the Abu Dhabi National Oil Co., has been tasked with changing the world's climate course, while the company he heads is actually one of the world's largest oil producers. The UAE, as you're probably aware, is the world's seventh largest liquid fuel producer. But let's take you through the key issues to watch out for at this COP. Well, the primary focus will be on the UN's first ever global stocktake, assessing global progress in addressing climate change. This stocktake is crucial as it reveals how far the world is from achieving the goal of limiting global temperature rise to 1.5 degrees Celsius. Now, the key issues also include fast-tracking energy transition. This revolves around renewable energy and food and agricultural systems. Fixing climate finance, well, this aspect aims to prioritize the global south in adaptation finance and help vulnerable communities rebuild after climate disasters, among other targets as well. Enhancing the role of urban areas in climate action, given their substantial contribution to CO2 emissions, with an emphasis on partnerships between local and national governments, is also likely to be top of the agenda too. The other crucial area is loss and damage compensation and climate financing strategies. Now, loss and damage actually refers to the negative consequences that arise from the unavoidable risks of climate change, like rising sea levels, prolonged heat waves, desertification, the acidification of the sea, as well as extreme events like species extinction and crop failures. The COP28 will also address failures in food systems by improving food security, reducing agricultural emissions, and promoting sustainable food practices. Phasing out fossil fuels is also going to be a primary focus. But while this year's climate financing agenda aims to better support developing nations with emergency funding, such mechanisms currently lack effective needs analysis and involve the inefficient distribution of funds. High debts imposed on such countries through global financing structures also reduce their ability to invest in the maintenance of climate projects.
All right, so what are some of the key issues? I'm going to go through a couple of key themes, a couple of key facts, so that we can try and understand a little bit more about what's at stake. Dr. Ashok Khosla, Chair of Development Alternatives, with me. I'm also joined by Ashwini Hingne, Associate Program Director at the World Resources Institute of India, and Vineet Mittal, Chairperson of the Avaada Group. Let me go across to Dr. Khosla first. Here's a reality check. The global north, in fact, before that, the nine countries in the global south, only nine countries in the global south have functional nuclear reactors. The reason I'm pointing this out is that if one speaks about clean energy, many suggest that nuclear power plants are the way to go. But there is a huge divergence, you know, among those who have it and those who don't. If we are to solve the problem, we need to go over this. We need to get over this, right?
Wrong. I don't think that nuclear power is going to be able to save us from climate change issues facing us. First of all, it has its own baggage. there's major problems with nuclear power in all those nine countries, and disposable wastes, possible accidents, a variety of other things make, in my opinion, nuclear power a very poor substitute for going to renewables. Renewables means things like solar energy, water energy, hydropower, and wind. And these are the kinds of essential areas that we need to look at. And there, I think India's, the global south is doing somewhat better. In essence, the difference between the number of countries owning functional nuclear power plants and the rest is not a meaningful statement from the point of view of climate change.
Okay. Ashwini Hingne, the global north has four times more power capacity than south. Again, if we are looking at climate change, if we are looking at ensuring that the utilization of power is equitable and that it is clean or relatively clean going forward, the south continues to suffer and it is unfair. Isn't that what COP28 is essentially about, addressing the disparity which exists?
Yeah, I think the COP28 or any COP, the whole mechanism of the climate talks aims to bring together all kinds of countries, developing countries, developed countries, those which are, like the initial section said, oil-producing countries as well as others, come together to globally cooperate on an issue that affects everybody. It is a fact that almost 70% of the world yet lacks access to reliable power, and India itself has prioritized reliable, affordable power and energy per se for its people. So definitely there is that inequity, and renewable energy and clean energy, non-fossil waste energy has been the primary focus even within countries that are in the global south. So a lot of the growth in renewable energy that we are seeing globally has also been in the global south. And that is one of the means through which more sustainable and reliable energy can be propagated and made accessible to people even in the global south, particularly countries like India.
Ashwini Hingne, again, it's an issue of disparity. Two major powers, economic powers, China and India. If you look at a 2020 statistic, China generated 4.4 times more power from fossil fuels than India. Now, India, and the argument which has been made, and it's a historic argument, that it's all very well to talk about moving to sustainable fuels. There is no alternative. It's been suggested that nuclear may not be the way forward, but of course there are lots of other ways of generating power. But in the interim period, India needs to fuel our aspirations, our economic growth, and therefore how is it fair in a country like India to have China generate 4.4 times more power from fossil fuels than India when everybody needs to be addressing this issue equally?
Well, I think India
Ashwini, half a second.
Sorry.
I meant to go across to Vineet. Go ahead, Vineet.
Okay. Sure.
So was the China question for me?
Yes.
So if you look at from an Indian context, India has taken a very pragmatic approach towards this. What we have done is we have laid down a very ambitious plan for solar, which is... we have one of the best track record in the world of implementing it, matched by wind power and pumped hydro capacity. So what India is doing, though India is continuing to invest in thermal, but our large strategy is to decarbonize our entire grid. And we are not doing as a matter of competing with China, but we are doing it because it's the right thing to do. And now solar, wind and pumped hydro is more competitive than new thermal power plants. So the time which we are taking to expand our grid from around 175 gigawatt of green power to 500 gigawatt of green power, I think during that time we will continue to expand our coal capacity. But then you will see a huge decline. So by 2030, we are targeting around 50% energy to come from solar, wind and pumped hydro and batteries, and then eventually declining further.
Sure.
So I think India has built a very good plan for its decarbonizing the grid. And on top of that, now we have a very ambitious plan for adoption of green hydrogen, green ammonia and green methanol. So 80% of our energy, which was not getting decarbonized or talked about, is in the form of green gray fuel, which we are converting through green hydrogen technology into green fuels. And
right.
India has taken a very...
And I just wanted to get to green hydrogen a little bit with Dr. Khosta. India's 5 mm TPA green hydrogen target by 2030. Some would say it's very ambitious. If it works out, it would be brilliant. But how, what is the cost structure associated with that? And will it be brought down to a level where it is feasible?
Well, look, first of all, I think we should be clear that hydrogen is not, green or otherwise, it's not a source of energy. It's a carrier of energy. In order to have energy, you've got to get it either from solar or wind or thermal or nuclear. But it is to be converted into hydrogen, which can be moved around, fit into airplanes, into cars, and into batteries and so on. So green hydrogen is not a source, but rather a carrier of energy, and we need to keep that in mind. It's going through growing pains. Every technology has certain needs in terms of innovation, which costs money, and green hydrogen, it will be a fair amount of time over the next few years, during which hopefully it becomes viable commercially and otherwise. Green hydrogen is a wonderful method of using energy better in a more environmentally sound way, and it's certainly in the future going to be a major player for getting us out of the climate conundrum that we find ourselves in.
You know, speaking of that climate conundrum, Ashwini Hingne, climate change has made South Asian heat waves 30 times more likely. The reason I say this is because as we talk about technology and technology solutions and disparity, the fact is this is all upon us now. We can't wish it away.
That's right. So one of the things that we have to keep in mind is the fact that even if we get to our goal of 1.5 degrees, limiting the temperature increase to 1.5 degrees, we will still experience climate change, which we are already doing. So there is a very clear need to build resilience amongst the people, especially in urban areas where the impacts of these are much more because of the urban heat island effect, as well as for informal workers who are working in very, very basic conditions, as well as construction workers. So there is a need for developing response measures towards climate impacts that are already happening to make them more available and more social already, so that people know how to respond to climate change. The infrastructure that we are building, that a lot of infrastructure that we are yet to build, has to be made in a way that is also resilient to such impacts that are coming up, and we need to also retrofit some of our existing buildings and other structures so that the people who are habiting these premises are able to cope with such impacts of climate change.
Vineet Mittal, if you look at the continent of Africa, 40% of the world's solar potential lies in Africa, but the installed capacity is just at 2%. There is an issue of cost and technology transfer. Again, when one looks at COP28, what is likely to be suggested, or what can we realistically expect, in terms of financing being better available, technology transfer being better available?
If you look at, there is a big disparity in the accessibility of the finance in Africa or largely global South. And the reason Africa has not been able to capitalize on its potential is largely to do with the lack of consistent policies and lack of established ecosystem and availability of capital for them to solve for the energy availability as well as energy cost and going green. So to address this problem, the COP28 presidency this time has taken a target to devise a funding plan to bridge global South at large. They have a $1 trillion shortfall in financing for mitigation and adoption of greener technology. And the way to address it is through multi-billion dollar guarantees from world's largest emitter. And those guarantees can be given to multilateral development bank, which can actually multiply their funding by 4 to 5 times through resources available with them. So this initiative was discussed even at G20 and B20 to use the strategic use of guarantees and N.K. Singh and former U.S. Treasury Secretary Lawrence Summer. They had suggested that using these guarantees to multilateral banks, World Bank itself can increase its annual spending to almost triple to $390 billion. And there was a plan made.
Right.
So I think one of the way to evaluate the success of this COPs will also be, in addition to global stock taking, is implementing what was agreed in the Paris Agreement in the form of Article 6 and $100 billion support from developed world to developing nation, and also the step towards mobilizing this $1 trillion annual investment required in Africa and larger global south,
sure,
to accelerate the energy transition.
Dr. Khosla, the bottom line over here for a larger audience, at what stage, when one talks about a rise in temperatures, does it start getting irreversible? Our battle now is 1.5 degrees, keep it beneath that. But as we approach 2 degrees, what starts happening?
What starts happening to cause irreversible change is that at a certain point, probably a little over 2 degrees, we don't know for sure, but scientists believe it's in that ballpark, things start happening in nature that accelerate the change towards higher temperatures. In other words, there's a positive feedback loop, which is a technical term to say there's a mutually reinforcing system, which then goes out of control. For example, you have in the Arctic a great deal of permafrost, and under that is a frozen ocean of methane, methane being a very nasty greenhouse gas. Once the temperature gets to a certain stage, somewhere between 2 and 3 degrees, this methane gets released and multiplies the effect. And so it actually reinforces the warming cycles and engine of the Earth. And then there is no stopping. And that is what is called irreversible. And that, you know, we don't have much leeway at the moment. We're probably coming close to the stage where big bubbles of methane will be coming out of the permafrost, and we wouldn't be able to control it. There are many other natural processes which have these characteristics of being positively feedbacked, and so you're going to have a real problem. But I do want to just get back to what Vineet was saying and what I think we need to keep in mind. And that is, we go to all these conferences. Now, this is the 28th climate change conference, and we go there from the South saying we need more money and we need your technologies. You know, your technologies are what has got us into the problem in the first place. We don't need those technologies. We need totally different technologies. And I'll come to us in a second to the kind of technologies we do need. We do need money. You can't do very much in the way of developing infrastructure and solutions without some capital. But frankly, it is a misnomer. It's a way of getting misled to keep thinking that those are the major issues. The major issues are transforming our lifestyles. The major issues are finding new ways to reduce energy use per capita and the aggregate. New forms of efficiencies for reducing the energy use, for getting what you want, doing more with less energy. These are the things that we really need to find ways for both the North and the South to do. And there are ways in which this global South can actually contribute. So I just want to be sure that people don't go away thinking that the nasty rich people are preventing us from doing what we have to do. They were nasty over the last two centuries because they caused the problem. That's true. But now the solution lies for all of us to deal with. And it seems to me it's time to get away from this mindset that somebody owes us something. And I also want to just add that it's not just energy. Energy is a major form of carbon emissions which are causing the problem if we use fossil energy. But there are many other things we can do. The global economy produces 20% of the carbon produced by the global economy comes actually not from burning fossil fuels, but from building materials, making building materials. And if you start using more greener building materials, you can make a massive cut in the kind of carbon emissions we're producing. There are many other ways in transport.
But Dr. Khosla, I just wanted come back to a key point which I began on. Now, I'm no advocate for nuclear power, but many people around the world are. In terms of emissions, nuclear plants don't emit in the same manner in which fossil fuels obviously do. There is prototyping now or thought of even of fusion being a possibility in the not too distant future. We don't know where that is all headed. I understand there's an incredible cost associated with nuclear power. But given the fact that we are facing an emergency, this technology is upon us, right? Why should we shun it instead of thinking of it as being something that can meet our energy requirements while ensuring the temperatures don't go up?
Vishnu, this is a pretty sophisticated question you've raised towards the end of your program. It needs time to answer.
But go ahead,
all
sir.
I can tell you is I would like to say that if nuclear power was so good, then why do insurance companies not insure it? Just give me an example of a single nuclear power station which has been insured by a private insurance company.
Your argument is it's unsafe. Many would suggest that if you look at the history of nuclear power plants around the world, they are relatively safe, right?
Relative to what? I mean,
relative to any other power plant in the world.
We've
had Fukushima. I know we've had Chernobyl. But right? But, those have been problematic, but by and large, they are safe. I understand the situation in Ukraine as well. There's a war over there. Zaporizhia faces a threat. I understand that.
That's it. And you put your finger on it. The point is that insurance or safety doesn't depend on the number of events, but on the magnitude of those events multiplied by the numbers. And the magnitude is very significant. And the possibility of a huge problem coming up is so great. These are called black swan events, and one has to factor the mathematics of your probabilities in there to find out exactly what you mean. The number of people who die in airplane crashes is far smaller than the number of pedestrians crossing the street. But, we need to be able to look at the issues in a broader sense. And
so bottom line, Dr. Khosla, is it's unsafe. And therefore, it cannot be seen to be a reliable alternative on a broad-based level. That's your key point.
In addition, you have to add the cost of managing wastes. In addition, you have to manage all the safeguards of terrorism and a lot of other things. Yes, it's not safe. That's the primary problem. And if it were safer, it would be a good solution, sure. But I don't think that we proved its value in an overall sense yet.
Fair enough. I'd like to thank you all very much for joining us. We will be looking at what comes up at COP28. It is desperate now for all of us, billions around the world. We can keep having these discussions. Something needs to be done and quickly. Thank you all very much for being with us.